from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Bioethicist and health policy expert Ezekiel Emanuel says the window to defeat COVID-19 is the next 1 to 2 weeks. In a New York Times op-ed, Emanuel called for decisive action, including an immediate nationwide shelter-in-place policy. We learn more about his prescription for containing the coronavirus. Then, California has conducted some 67,000 COVID-19 tests as of yesterday. A big increase, but still not enough, according to Governor Gavin Newsom. We'll hear why California is still behind on testing and what's being done to test more people faster. Forum is next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny, who is on staycation. With us today is University of Pennsylvania Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. Emanuel says health experts are not overreacting, that the time to take decisive and extraordinary action against COVID-19 is now, or we risk millions dying. On Monday, Emanuel penned his policy prescription in a New York Times op-ed. Welcome to Forum, Ezekiel Emanuel.
Nice to be here. I love KQED.
Well, we are so happy to have you on, and I want to start by asking you, what's behind that specific calculation of the next 7 to 14 days to win the war against COVID-19?
Well, if you think that this virus is doubling every somewhere between 2.5 and 5 days, if we don't take decisive action, we're going to be up probably eightfold from where we are today in the millions of cases already. There's probably, the estimates have to be about 600,000 to 800,000 cases in the United States, rapidly spreading in places like New Orleans and places that did not heed the need to have physical distancing before. And we will be up in, 3 or 4 million by that time, and it'll be way too late. We won't be able to suppress it at all. And we really do need to act urgently before April 1st. If you just look at the epidemiological projections, April 1st, April 7th are, we've already lost lots of time. This is probably our last window to have a hope of suppression.
And by decisive action, you're talking about President Trump needing to immediately close all schools, order the closing of non-essential businesses, basically impose a shelter-in-place policy for the entire nation. Why that?
Well,
why isn't state-by-state enough?
I don't like shelter-in-place. I do think we need to have a quarantine. People do need to get out to get some fresh air with effective social distancing in place and not gather in groups. And that's absolutely critical to decrease the spread and turn the corner over the subsequent 4 weeks.
And why isn't state by state efforts? Why isn't that enough?
It's not enough. It's not a matter that it's not enough. It's totally ineffective. Not totally ineffective. That's an exaggeration. It's ineffective. So places that are taking serious action, like California, like Washington, like New York or Illinois, Michigan, many of these states, they're getting less bang for their buck. They're suffering all the pain of the economic curtailment of activity and not getting the full public health benefit. Why? Kids are doing spring fling down in Florida, interacting with people. Some of them are getting COVID-19 infections, and then they're going to return home. They're going to return home to New York, to San Francisco, to L.A., and infect people. And that's the problem. If you don't do it nationwide, you don't really restrict the virus, you're going to have travel that is going to reintroduce the virus. And we can see this in other countries that have, done a much better job than we have, like Taiwan or South Korea. What happens is you ease up on the restrictions and boom, it's typically someone who's been traveling that brings the new cases in, or someone who has one of these prolonged periods of shedding the virus who begins to spread it around. And we need that pause nationwide. Otherwise, we will just have, you know, proliferation in some city, call it Montgomery, Alabama, where they're not taking it seriously, and a bunch of people from Montgomery are going to go somewhere else and bring the virus with them.
And Dr. Emanuel, I know you know how much the economic pain is already being felt by Californians. I mean, how do you ask them and the rest of the country to absorb that too?
Because it's the only way forward. You know, people say, well, you're sacrificing young people to old people. You know, it's if we keep having this virus spread and you say have a 1% chance of dying, are you going to Disney World? Are you going to a conference that has 5,000-10,000 other people? You can open up the economy, but people, a lot of people are not going to participate if they think, well, I might have a 1% chance of dying. I might get it. I might be fine, but I might infect my parents or my grandmother. So I think unless we get a real handle, and, you know, 8 to 10 weeks is a severe time to sort of pause the economy. But, you know, we've now released $2.2 trillion. That's good. It's estimated for 3 months. We could use that time to really effectively address this problem and prepare to slowly ease up in June and not have the economic havoc. Because I am predicting that if we, you know, rush to not have a uniform quarantine policy and allow many people to pass the virus around, we're going to have these a roller coaster. We're going to have to impose this physical distancing, release it, reimpose it because we'll have a big outbreak in the number of COVID cases. That's not going to lead to robust economic recovery. That's going to lead to, oh, we're going to have another bailout because we're closing restaurants yet again. Yes. And so I think the alternative is not a realistic, it hasn't thought through what happens. And I think the last thing is, I don't, you know, we still have had a, you know, it is true we've had more than 1,000 deaths, but we haven't understood that if we don't do this, we will have more than 1 million or 2 million deaths by the end of the year. And the magnitude of that problem, I don't think, has fully sunk into people, especially people who are feeling well. You know, it's not just old people who will die. Yes, it's true about 60 or 65% of the people who will die will be over 70. But a lot of them are going to be under 70 and under 60. That's going to be a different kind of tragedy.
We're talking about what it will take to contain the coronavirus pandemic with Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, professor of medical ethics and health policy and vice provost of global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a former Obama White House health policy advisor. You know, we've been hearing over the last couple of days also sort of some of the things that you're saying echoed by Fed Chair Jerome Powell, who was saying, you know, we need to get the spread of the virus under control before we can resume economic activity. I mean, essentially your argument that the economy cannot be fixed without solving the pandemic. But of course, you know, this contrasts sharply with what the president has been saying. I mean, he wants to get Americans back to work by Easter. More recently, he was saying that the Democrats and the media want to shutter the economy to hurt his reelection prospects. So, I mean, where do you put the chances of decisive action at the federal level?
Well, it rests with presidential leadership. And, you know, whatever it was, about 10 days ago, he read the Imperial College report that predicted if you don't do something decisive, we'll have 2.2 million deaths. And he obviously changed his tone. I think it was March 16th that his tone significantly changed in the press conferences, recognizing that we really did need this quarantine and praising New York. And then towards the end of the week, you get, you know, an op-ed in the New York Times saying, oh, we don't have to be that serious. You get a bunch of economists saying, oh, you're going to tank the economy for seniors. And you get, you know, polling that suggests he's still strong with his base. And so he thinks he can back away. Then he gets these rallies in the stock market when he's throwing money at it. I just don't think that's a long-term gain. That's an immediate gain for, you know, getting jazzing the stock market up. But it's not a long-term thinking. Well, how you know, how do we get the whole economy, people going out, feeling safe at restaurants, at stores, people going and traveling, feeling safe if they travel, people allowing their kids to go to school, feeling safe that they won't bring home the COVID virus to the house, and everyone might get sick and, God forbid, seriously sick. You can't guarantee everything, but you can minimize the risks. And I don't think rushing into, you know, a premature date like Easter that bears no relationship to public health matters is logical reasonable. So I think if you look to China, what China did in Hubei province and Wuhan is they closed it sort of towards the end of January. It peaked over the next 4 weeks, and then it declined over the next 4 weeks. And so, you know, just in the last few days, they've been reporting no new cases of coronavirus. That's the kind of thing we have to do. It doesn't mean that you have no new cases, they're not anywhere. It means that you can slowly open the economy and quickly quarantine and isolate any new cases. You can build up a system ready for reopening the economy. We don't have that.
Right, but you're optimistic that that sort of perspective, that seriousness will be something that will take hold at the federal level. I mean, we didn't even have our Senator Rand Paul modeling physical distancing measures and swimming in the Senate gym and pool while awaiting his coronavirus test results. I bring that up because I know that you, as a bioethicist, really took the senator to task for that.
Yes, I think that was, first of all, as a physician, I was outraged by that behavior. It totally irresponsible. We're pledged, we take a pledge, and I'm sure Rand Paul took a pledge that he's going to put his patient interests first and his colleagues' interests first, and he didn't do any of that. It seemed to me, you know, this is a moment for leadership, and I don't think, you know, I'm just worried we won't have the leadership. I'm doing what I can do, which is to say, here are the steps you need to take, here's the plan. You know, I'm sympathetic to people who say you can't kill the economy. You know, the horrible thing, and I feel this very personally. I know a lot of people in the restaurant business, and you know, shutting down restaurants is really terrible. It throws people out of work, especially low wage, hardworking people. And, you know, we've got to give them a plan forward. I understand that. But you can't rush a plan because people aren't going to end up going to restaurants if they think they could have a 1% chance of dying. That isn't a reasonable thing. Oh, you're going to have a 1% chance if you go out and someone next to you has COVID-19 and, you know, by mistake coughs in your direction. That just makes no sense. You are not going to get robust economic activity that way.
We're talking with Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He's calling for a dramatic step up in federal action, including a mandatory nationwide quarantine. What do you think the federal government should be doing at this stage? What questions or concerns do you have? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also post your questions or comments on Facebook, Twitter, at KQED Forum, or email them to forum@kqed.org. So one of the other things that I'd like to hear from you, Dr. Emanuel, is your policy prescription for how to take decisive national action with regard to hospitals and our frontline health workers. I mean, we're already hearing terrible stories out of New York about hospitals beginning to be overwhelmed with coronavirus cases. And of course, we've been hearing for weeks how frontline health workers don't have the personal protective equipment that they need. What needs to happen here?
Whoa, that is just a huge, huge question. I mean, we clearly, you know, on the production side, certainly for personal protective equipment and ventilators, we need to ramp up alternative supplies. And this is not a non-trivial problem. You know, people are talking about a million masks here and a million masks there. And it's estimated by the Department of Health and Human Services in the course of the rest of the year, we're going to need 3.5 billion masks. You know, in a normal day, I understand that New York Presbyterian Hospital used about 1,000 masks, and now it's something in the range of 40,000 masks. It's just, you know, the demands are incredible. Same thing with respirators. So what, and by the way, probably the very much the rate limiting supply is personnel. You know, we only have in this country 75,000 or so respiratory therapists who actually manage those respirator, those ventilators. And, you know, we're going to be demanding them, and some of them are going to get sick. It's just going to be a huge shortage. So we need a concerted effort to get as much equipment, transform as much production as possible. The federal government needs to invest and provide money to companies to retool their production lines. That's the first thing. The second thing is we do need this quarantine in place to decrease the demand. Third, we need hospitals to look at how they're using the personal protective equipment and try to conserve it. I gave some suggestions in that New York Times article, like move all the IVs where you can outside of the room so that you don't have to don personal protective equipment to go in and change an IV or to stop the IV. We then need to rush from places that have a low level of COVID-19, don't really need those PPE, those protective equipment. We need to move them to places that do, like New York. We need to reposition and bring out a retirement and train people for some of the functions in the hospital to relieve highly skilled people to do the jobs of caring for these patients. And then I think if we do have the pause, we will allow hospitals to resupply themselves, allow the staff to recuperate. One of the things I'm really, really worried about is burnout and, you know, sort of PTSD. Working under these extreme conditions for weeks and weeks and weeks, burnout is a serious worry because it will mean we'll incapacitate critical staff that we need at this time. I've also argued that we take the testing out of hospitals and away from healthcare workers because we don't want them to be infected while they're testing people. This is something we can train other people who are COVID-19 immune to do.
Yeah, so like you mean like drive-through or walk-up places to get tested as opposed to being at the hospital themselves?
Absolutely, and we should just throw up, you know, literally tens of thousands of them across the country. It's really important to have easy testing, and we saw that in South Korea, in Taiwan. And remember, I think the president unfortunately minimized the importance of testing people who might have been exposed but are asymptomatic. We know that a large portion of people who get this virus are asymptomatic or have very mild symptoms that don't suggest to them that they have COVID. And that will mean that they'll spread it because they can't get a test and can't confirm that they might be positive.
You know, one of the things that we've been seeing and hearing in other nations that have had basically that have been completely overwhelmed are physicians making the incredible difficult decisions about who to save and who to let die. And I know as someone who's looked at this in terms of medical ethics, I mean, can you help us understand the calculation here and what you think would need to happen in a worst case scenario where physicians are confronted with those questions?
So I've been thinking about the issue of rationing during a pandemic for the last 15 years and what we have to do to prepare the healthcare system. And we've tried to outline the right ethical framework to help doctors and nurses and other people who are going to be on the front line of making this decision. Who gets the intensive care unit bed? Who gets the respirator? You know, most of us hope this would never be necessary, but we should have an ethical framework for, God forbid, the day when it would. And we all thought it would be a flu pandemic. And here we have COVID-19, and it is making finally these decisions necessary. We haven't trained our medical staff and our nursing staff to confront these decisions. But there is a framework. There's a clear way of doing it, and we've written a New England Journal paper on Monday about this. The first and most important thing we need to understand is that we want to maximize benefits. That means save the most lives, but also save the lives of people who have the best prognosis. And it's important that we have to balance those two. You know, when firemen run into a house, they run in and they just grab people, not thinking about it. But we can't think just maximize the number of lives saved. We also need to think about who's likely, if we save them, to have the best prognosis for living a long time. And I think that's a deep ethical value that people share. The other thing we need to think about is the frontline healthcare workers. These people are taking risks now. If they get sick, we also want them to be able to come back to work. And so we need to prioritize them. There's a shorthand we say in the ethics world that, you know, if there's some disaster on the plane, you save the pilot first, because the pilot, not because he's or she is special, but because they can save everyone else on the plane. The same thing is true with our healthcare workers. We have to save our healthcare workers, not because they're special people and doctors and nurses are special people. They are special people in my view, but because they can save and care for many other people and save their lives. And that's something we need to prioritize, those people. Another important value, which I think is not fully recognized in the heat of the moment, is just because a patient has COVID doesn't mean they take priority over patients that might have heart disease or cancer or multiple sclerosis or any number of other conditions. When we're having to ration these resources because of the virus, we have to treat these patients all the same. And we have to give just as much priority to patients with non-COVID diseases as the patients with COVID diseases.
Well, we've got a lot of calls and comments coming in, and I'll start with Francis, who writes, in China, Wuhan was isolated as the epicenter of China. Should New York City, as the epicenter of the U.S. now, also be isolated?
That's a great question, but the problem is we should have asked that question weeks ago and not today. Today, the virus is all across the country. You may not see it in your particular part of the country, but that's not because it's not there. It's because we haven't tested and we haven't done the right work. But the virus is there, and so isolating New York will not solve this problem. Isolating, you know, and we can see this because it's true. New Orleans 2 weeks ago might have had almost no cases. I don't know exactly how many it has, but now it's on the upward exponential growth. So isolating New York will not solve the New Orleans problem. And New Orleans is just an example. That it's true everywhere. Phoenix, Atlanta, Georgia, Tampa.
And Curtis writes, rural America has yet to be hit by COVID-19. Rural medical care is ill-prepared for when the virus moves in. What can rural Americans do to prepare for the inevitable crisis?
Well, first of all, rural America, it is true. We haven't seen it there, but that's, again, probably because of inadequate testing, not because it's not there. Rural Americans travel to cities and then go back to the rural areas. We need the same approach as we have in other places. We need this physical distancing. We need people to take seriously not getting within 3 to 6 feet of other people. And that may be easier in rural areas, but it has to be implemented. If it's not implemented, it won't do any good to prevent the spread of the virus.
We'll take more of your questions and calls for Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about what it will take to contain the coronavirus pandemic with Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, professor of medical ethics and health policy and vice provost of global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, also a former Obama White House health policy advisor. What do you think the federal government should be doing at this stage? What are your questions for Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel? Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or post your questions or comments on Facebook, Twitter, at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And I'll start first with Anrutha in San Jose. Hi, Anrutha.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
My question is, first of all, I completely agree with having an entire shutdown just to prevent the virus from further spreading. I do think as a society that does look like the right thing to do. But on the other hand, with the schools being shut down and as a family where both me and my spouse were working, how do we manage expectations with our companies, our organizations, to really say, hey, we're not only having a full-time job, but we also have children for whom we have to provide care. How can we essentially support this, not just from social distancing in sort of the physical world, but also setting the right expectations organization-wise so that we do this as an entire society?
Dr. Emanuel?
That is a really good question about how employers appreciate the imposition this is creating. And I think, you know, I may be looking at this with rose-colored glasses. I think this crisis is going to educate us in many, many, many ways. Big companies is going to make them rethink their supply chain, rethink relying too much on one country like China and that kind of diversification. I am really hopeful that this will make companies be much more aware of the burdens that parents have in juggling all their different roles and trying to make the workplace more family friendly being aware of that, especially when you have two-parent households. Not everything is going to be possible all the time, and we need to have more flexibility built in to how we work. It's not that people who have kids work less. They tend to work longer hours and fit things in, and I think that's important. And hopefully, enlightened businesses are going to be aware that, you know, there are certain advantages to this. You're not spending probably an hour or something a little more commuting to work. That hour can go into time spent with your family or other things. But they do have to understand that flexibility is really important. There's no law that is going to make them understand flexibility is more important. It's only understanding that that's the way to get the maximum productivity out of workers who, you know, by and large, want to do a good job. They're not, you know, trying to be lazy about this. They're just having to juggle many things like helping their kids learn and, you know, schooling them at home. And I'm totally sympathetic. I don't think there's a magic wand here other than, again, leadership.
Well, thanks for the question, Anrutha. Let me go next to Kathleen in Oakland. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay, my question is, are healthcare workers and hospitals segregating themselves between the COVID caretakers and hospitals and the non-COVID caretakers and hospitals the way they apparently did in some other countries?
Dr. Emanuel?
Wait, I'm not sure I understand that. Can you say that again?
I think she's asking about the separation of COVID patients and healthcare workers at hospitals. Are they actually like being segregated within hospitals? Or should they be?
Well, certainly you need to segregate COVID patients from non-COVID patients because you don't want them to spill over. It's very, you know, I mean, healthcare workers, there aren't enough COVID positive healthcare workers to take care, I think, of all the COVID patients. So it's going to be impossible to do that. And that's why we have personal.
I didn't mean COVID positive healthcare workers. I meant healthcare workers who were dedicated
working with COVID patients.
Exactly. Versus the other healthcare workers who never work with COVID patients.
Yeah, I just think that's not going to be a scenario which we can, you know, enforce because there aren't enough. I think I said this. There aren't enough COVID positive healthcare workers at the moment to care for all the COVID positive patients. So I don't see how that is going to be a plausible approach. If a COVID positive healthcare worker is out and not shedding virus, they're actually immune and they're not going to spread it to a non-COVID patient.
Well, so on a similar vein,
You might have a situation weeks from now where we have enough COVID positive healthcare workers, God forbid, because a lot of them will be out for 14 days not providing patient care. But you might end up in that situation where you would have a sufficient number to care for all the COVID positive patients. But today, that's not the case. And so having this kind of separation wouldn't be possible.
Well, thanks for the question, Kathleen. And Rose writes, we know that Trump will not act on your guest's recommendation. So what choices do we have other than using our own personal precautions? It's enraging to hear how Trump every day promises this and that and finding out his promises have been empty. When Trump lies, people die. You know, is that true? Is it just using our own personal precautions, or what can we do if we agree with your policy prescription? If people agree with that, what can they do to put pressure?
Well, first of all, I do want to praise your governor. Gavin Newsom has been a standout, one of the really leaders in this and taking the bull by the horns and not shrinking from the big challenges and the big decisions. I mean, he, along with Jay Inslee in Washington State, Cuomo, Larry Hogan in Maryland, and Mike DeWine in Ohio, and many others, Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, many governors have done a very good job. And, you know, we need that kind of leadership, both to demonstrate what leadership is and to demonstrate to the country how these policies can make a difference. You know, hopefully putting in these policies, while less than optimal because they're not systematic, they're more of a patchwork, will make a difference in, you know, places like San Francisco and other parts of California. And then once they begin to make a difference, hopefully other parts of the country will see that and be willing to enroll. I understand your frustration. It's a frustration that lots of people have with what has been sort of limited federal leadership, and in some areas like testing, you know, just a lot of mistakes.
Yes, and so let's finish. I know you need to leave us, Ezekiel Emanuel.
Sorry.
In a few minutes. And so this listener writes, hasn't the CDC made a lot of mistakes since the beginning? They mess up the first batch of tests. Their director dodged questions at a congressional hearing, etc. Why are we still supposed to always trust the CDC now? And I'd love for you to comment on this, both from the testing perspective, what needs to happen related to testing, and also on the trust perspective, because I know you've thought about both a lot.
Well, I do think that we're getting our you know, it's been a slow and painful and frustrating process in getting our arms around the testing thing. I think we're beginning to see that dramatically change. It needs to change a lot more. As I said earlier, you know, we need to have these drive up and walk through testing everywhere. We need thousands of them built quickly, and we need to train people to be able to do the tests. So I think that's very fundamentally important. I would say that it is true that the CDC decided to make its own tests and then had multiple mistakes in that process, and multiple promises that were never fulfilled about the number of tests sent out, lacking reagents, and sending out the wrong test kits. That is a serious problem, and it undermines public trust. But it does show you what happens, I think, when we don't recognize, outside of emergency circumstances, the very important role that scientists and other government workers play in protecting us. We often bash the government. You know, Ronald Reagan famously said, you know, the six most dangerous words in the world is, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. And yet in a crisis, what do we want? We want the government to come and help. And you can't have them ready to come and help in an emergency unless we invest in them and recognize the really important work they're doing and support them. Many scientists have other alternative jobs. They're well, you know, sought after by the private sector. And if we keep denigrating them and keep undermining them in non-emergent circumstances, they're not going to be around when we need them in an emergency. Again, this is, we have an acute problem, and hopefully we're over the acute problem, because we have the big lab corporations, we have big companies that have made the tests and are successful, and will deploy it. But this is a long-term attitudinal change, that the government isn't our enemy. The government very often is our friend, and it's sitting there ready to help us in these emergencies, but only if we support it and recognize it. And if we are constantly bad-mouthing it, it won't be there when we need them for hurricanes or earthquakes or, God forbid, the next infectious disease emergency.
Well, Dr. Emanuel, we are very glad that you were here with us on Forum today to share your policy prescription. Ezekiel Emanuel, Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on KQED.
We'll have more for him in just a moment.